grateful for times when we can come into your presence and we can open your word. Today, Lord, we lift up brothers and sisters in Christ who don't enjoy the freedoms of assembly that we have here. We ask that you would keep them safe today and that you would bless their times of assembling together. And Lord, today as we open up your word, and Jesus, as we look at things that you said about your second coming in the end of the age, it's my prayer that by your Spirit you would bless our understanding in Jesus' name. Amen. 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 Well, we have a verse for the journey. I'll move out of the way so you can see it, and let's say it together from Hebrews 9, 27 and 28. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. Today we're going to be focusing our attention on Matthew chapter 24, although we'll be looking at Mark and Luke as well, because we're going to be looking at Jesus' teaching concerning the end of the age in the section that scholars call the Olivet Discourse. The reason they call it that is because Jesus was talking and he was on the Mount of Olives. It's like, I don't know why we have to give things names, but this is the Olivet Discourse. And Jesus has been asked by his disciples some important questions, and here's what they ask. Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when his disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here will be left upon another, which will not be torn down." As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things happen? Question one. And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?" Well, we know, actually, that in 70 AD, Titus, a Roman general, destroyed the buildings of the temple, Jerusalem, or else the armies that he had conscripted destroyed it, depending on whose version you take. Nevertheless, whoever did it was under the auspices of Rome when they destroyed it. But I want us to think for a minute about what the temple was like and what a big deal it really was to think about all these buildings being destroyed. So here's a picture of the Temple Mount. This is the south side right here. There are all kinds of ceremonial baths that are believed to have been along the south side, and then quite a lot of steps going up. Remember when I talked to you about the fact that even though the sheep are to the south of the temple, you can't bring them in the south? You can see this height right here is, depending on who you believe, well, somewhere between 240 feet and 400 feet to the floor. And so here are the Temple Mount the way it was at the time of Jesus. Most worshipers would have gone in here, but some would have gone in here. This is where you go in when you go to the Temple Mount now, if you get on it. And this area right here is the section that's now called the Wailing Wall, the Western Wall, which is just the closest you can get to where the Holy of Holies was. Where the tall building, which contained the Holy of Holies, the Holy Place, and the Holy of Holies, is located there, is where the Dome of the Rock is today. The Dome of the Rock is a Muslim shrine. It's not actually a mosque. The mosque that's on the Temple Mount is right here. It's the Al-Aqsa Mosque. You can go in the mosque now. You can no longer go in the Dome of the Rock. When we were there a number of years ago, you could go in the Dome of the Rock, which is the whole Temple Mount, it has a very bad feeling to it because, hey, it's completely controlled by Islam and it's the place where the temple is supposed to be. So that entire complex of the Temple Mount is about 40 acres, not quite 40 acres. If you include the steps and the things beside it, it's a bit more than 40 acres. And up here in the corner, the building up in the corner is a fortress. It was the Fortress Antonia, and it was built there intentionally so that the Romans could look into the temple and see what was going on in the temple to have some control over it. Just to give you an idea of scale, Fortress Antonia could billet 1,500 soldiers. So this is a big complex with a lot of buildings. I have a couple of other pictures. We're looking at it here from the southeast corner. Now we're going to look at it from the southwest corner. This gives you a little bit more of an idea about how much of a hill it is. Here, this was called the pinnacle of the temple. This is where Jesus was tempted to throw himself off. Would have been multiple stories down, depending on who you believe, anywhere from 20 to about 32 stories down there. This is where they tossed James, who was the head of the Jerusalem church, off that place. And then when he wasn't quite dead, they beat him to death with clubs. Nice people. And now here you can see why you would have walked the sheep right up the east side of the Temple Mount to where you could bring them in on the north side, because it made like a natural ramp to bring them up the Kidron Valley. I've got a couple more pictures. Now we're going to be standing right at the inner part of the temple where we see where the Holy of Holies and the Holy Place were under roof. This then is the area that was reserved for Jewish people. Everything else would have been considered the court of the Gentiles or the court of the nations. And that's where they set up all of the sales for all of the things you might need for Passover, or where you could exchange money, or where you could buy lambs or buy doves or whatever. So this area had signs on it that said, nobody, if you can't go in this, I can't remember exact wording, you can't go in there if you're not Jewish. If you go in there, you can only blame yourself for the fact that you're going to die. That essentially is what it said. And remember that Paul was really in trouble because they thought he took Trophimus the Ephesians past that wall. So this area immediately here was called the Court of the Women, inside there. Then, believe it or not, it's so huge, there's two more courts here. One is the Court of Israel, which would be for the men, and then the next one is the priests and the altar, before you went in to the under roof part of the temple itself. And just to give you an idea about how big the Temple Mount was compared to Jerusalem at the time of Jesus, there it is. It's amazingly huge compared to the city. Way up at the top, you see the two pools off to the north. Those are the pools of Bethesda. Down here is the pool of Siloam. You've got Hezekiah's tunnel coming from the Gihon Spring here. The city that David conquered, just start here, come down like this, go back around like this. Just that one little finger of land, which sticks out kind of on a jutted out piece, falls off on both sides, is the city of David. Up here, the big palace you see is Herod's palace. Right here in the Essene section is where Jesus is supposed to have had the Last Supper. So when you start thinking about all the buildings that are there on the Temple Mount and all of those being destroyed, it's fairly amazing. It's a lot of destruction to happen. In fact, on the west side of the temple, you can see places where there was a Roman street below that they've excavated. And you see where these ginormous stones were rolled off when the temple was burned and just crushed the street, knocked it in, you know, feet when they fell. So they're asking Jesus two questions. It's like, all these buildings are going to go away. When is this going to happen? And that's the big question. And interestingly enough, Matthew doesn't really answer that question. He doesn't record the answer. Jesus answered it, but Matthew didn't record it. But Luke did. The interesting thing is, I believe when the disciples asked the question, when's this going to happen and what will be the sign of your coming, I think they thought the two went together, that they were going to happen together, because they were reading the prophecy of Zechariah. And we know at the time of Jesus that there were rabbis who were writing about the coming of the Messiah, etc., and they were quoting this Zechariah prophecy. We'll look at it in a minute. But here's what Jesus said in answer to their first question, when will this happen? When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave. Those who are in the country must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. They will fall by the edge of the sword, will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So then the question is, when did this happen? When will it happen? And I think the answer to this is, this happened. This happened in 70 AD, certainly, and the Gentiles are still, to this day, trampling Jerusalem underfoot. I think we have to say, if there is a mosque and a Muslim shrine on top of the Temple Mount, it's pretty well being trampled by the Gentiles. And so we look at it and we say that. Now, why would they have thought that the coming of the Messiah and the destruction of Jerusalem went together? Well, because of what they were reading about in Zechariah. And we know that the rabbis were extremely interested in it. There are multiple rabbis who wrote about it from the time shortly after Jesus. Remember we talked about how prophets will see an event, then they see another event and another event. It's like they're seeing the top of a mountain. They're over here and they're looking and they're seeing the top of the mountain, but they're not seeing the events in between or how much time is in between. So they get all the events right, but not necessarily the timing of them. They may get the order of the timing, but not the time that goes in between. Here's the problem that they had. Zechariah 14, first mountain. Behold, a day is coming for the Lord when the spoil taken from you will be divided among you, for I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle, and the city will be captured. The houses plundered, the women ravished, and half the city exiled, but the rest of the people will not be cut off from the city. Okay, that happened in 70. Now, here's the second part of his prophecy, and I think we're seeing the next mountain. Then the Lord will go forth and fight against those nations as when he fights on a day of battle. In that day, his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will be moved toward the north and the other half toward the south. So essentially, Zechariah is saying there's going to be this time when Jerusalem is plundered, and then there's going to be the time when the Messiah comes and he's going to step down on the Mount of Olives. This is important. Either the first part happened in 70 and the second part hasn't happened yet, or we're waiting for both parts to happen because the first part might be about the future of Jerusalem at the end of the age. It certainly fits there. But certainly it didn't all happen when everybody thought it was going to happen. And so consequently, looking at this prophecy, you can understand why they're thinking, okay, if something bad is coming up right away, then we have to remember that means the Messiah is coming. That's what they would have been thinking. So Jesus now is going to talk to us about the last 7 weeks of Daniel's vision. Remember when we saw Daniel's vision of the 70 weeks of years? And we said that there have already been 69 of them have happened, but there is one more week of years, one more seven-year period still to come. We call that seven-year period the tribulation. And Jesus is going to start speaking to us about the first 3.5 years of that last seven. That last seven is generally divided into the tribulation and the great tribulation. You really don't want to be around during the great tribulation because the Antichrist has revealed all kinds of trouble. The first half is bad enough. So Jesus, they've asked Jesus, how are we going to know? And so he's answering that question for them. For many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many. I have a list of people who have claimed to be Jesus, and it's huge. It's absolutely enormous. Some of them we know, Jim Jones, David Koresh, those are familiar names. I'm really interested in this guy. I mean, do you think he's trying to look like Jesus or what? His name is Sergei Torop, but he's known to by his followers as Vissarion, which means the guy who gives life. He calls himself the Word of God. The reason I'm really interested in him, I'll back up a few sentences here. I work with an organization. I'm the director of an organization called the Christian Resource Center. It's a not-for-profit, and what we do is develop curriculum for people in various parts of the world. And so one of the places we're working in quite actively is Eastern Europe. Our director in Eastern Europe is an MBA and a seminary grad, so he's really qualified. He is working with people in southern Siberia to plant a church. And the church is, if you look at where Russia, Siberia comes together and meets Mongolia and China, right there is where they're going to plant a church. Right there is where that guy is claiming to be Jesus. So it's very interesting. So I've got a particular interest in him. If you look on the internet, it says that he has about 50,000 followers. The people in Siberia say, oh, way more than that. People really, really believe that he's Jesus who has returned. And he certainly is doing nothing to make them think anything else. He does all of these blessings and all manner of things, all the while rejecting his first wife because apparently she just did not understand how to be married to Jesus. Go figure. And now he's also estranged from his second wife, but all of this is very Jesus-like, don't you think? But I will say, he looks like him. I mean, he intentionally tries to look like Jesus. And he is just especially egregious, but he's just kind of in a line. So we do know that there are a lot of people in the world today who are claiming to be Jesus and who are leading a lot of people astray. We also know that ultimately there's going to be the ultimate guy who claims to be God. You know, so we have all of these guys like him and others who are really a type of Antichrist. Antichrist means either against Christ or in place of Christ. And certainly, they're both. And so there are a lot of them. And the quintessential big one that's coming, we read about in Revelation 6. says, I saw when the Lamb broke one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying, as with a voice of thunder, come. I looked, and a white horse, and he who sat on it had a bow. A crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. We can't convince ourselves just from this that it's the Antichrist, but it is. If we read on more chapters, we would figure out, oh yeah, this is the Antichrist. Kind of tricky to ride a white horse, you know, because the good guy always rode a white horse. Except for Zorro. I've never been able to figure out Zorro. He messed the whole thing up. But the good guy's usually riding a white horse, and this guy appears to be good. When he first comes on the scene, he appears to be good. Here's some interesting information, I think. We, a number of years ago, had an outreach to the mosque on campus. Not that it went all that well. Everybody was perfectly polite to us, but nobody changed their mind about what they believed, and we didn't change our mind either. And after that, I met with a number of Muslim girls who were trying to figure out if they had missed anything by not knowing about Christianity. And so that didn't go that well either. Although I didn't, you never know, because I told them about Jesus. You never know what happens in the future. But the interesting thing is that in the course of all of this, I discovered that the Muslims believe that parts of the Bible were actually given by Allah, and they were good. But unfortunately, the infidels have messed up a bunch of them, and so it's no longer really accurate. And then, of course, the infidels also added things to it that Allah didn't originally give. So all the way around, they accept parts of the Bible. Interestingly enough, this is one of the parts they accept. It's like, why? Because they are saying to us that their Mahdi is this guy on the white horse. It's like, you don't really know how I would think about that, or you wouldn't be saying that to me. But they do believe that their Mahdi, who is coming, is the guy on the white horse. And they will say so, and have said so, and have published things that say so. So it's really quite an interesting thing, because I'm looking at this thinking it's the Antichrist. They're looking at it and saying it's their Mahdi, and I'm going, and what if they're the same person? Because I'm thinking that may very well be the case. We certainly know about this Antichrist here that's being described in Revelation, that we are told in 2 Thessalonians, he opposes and exalts himself above every so-called god or object of worship, and he takes his seat in the temple of God, displaying himself as being God. Wow. So this guy is really, really not a good guy. He is somebody who ultimately is coming at the end, and he's going to lead all kinds of people astray. Then Jesus goes on and he says, you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. Well, we certainly have that. But then again, I wonder what time in history we didn't have that. Yeah, but right now we have a lot of it for sure. See that you're not frightened, for these things must take place, but that is not yet the end. Nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom. In various places there will be famines and earthquakes. So this is a series of signs, but I look at this and I think, but Jesus, these things have been happening from the beginning of time. They've always been happening. So we have to look at them and say they must be happening with an incidence or something that causes us to go, whoa, we can tell something unusual is happening. Nation means ethnic group. Ethnos is nation here. Ethnos is a group of people who are kind of assembled together because of a common belief system, including religion, because of a common race. So when we talk about an ethnic group against ethnic group, you don't really have to look too far in the world today to see ethnic group against ethnic group, do you? And kingdom against kingdom. This would be more like we think of as country fighting country. And it says, in various places there will be famines. Interestingly enough, the famine word does not have to mean that there is no food. The famine word here means people are hungry. So it could be that there's not food, or it could be that they are so destitute that they have no money to buy food. Either one would qualify in translating this word. There will be famines and there will be earthquakes. You know, I started looking, okay, have there been more earthquakes than usual? There have been a lot, but then again, I only got the earthquake app a little while ago, and so I only started paying attention to them a little while ago. Seems like there's a whole bunch of earthquakes all the time, but I guess there have always been a whole bunch of earthquakes all the time, and I didn't know. However, there was a very interesting bunch of research done and a little program done about it by one of the news networks. And it said that in the past decade, the incidence of what they call great earthquakes is up 265%. Does that qualify for what's being spoken of here? I don't know. Seems kind of significant to me. But then again, I'm not really an earthquake expert, but we do know that we see these things. We see ethnic strife. We see wars and rumors of wars. There are parts of the world that are experiencing grave famine. Somalia. Right now, Yemen is in terrible trouble. The UN has now said, and you know how I love the UN, they said if we don't do something quickly, we're going to have a humanitarian crisis there that's greater than anything since World War II. And that's a pretty big humanitarian crisis. We know that there are a lot of problems with sufficient food in Venezuela, for example. And in parts of Eastern Europe, we can't even figure out what the shortages are because there's nobody in the government who's willing to say what the shortages are. So how do you know if the government is trying to hide from you what the shortages are? I know from having a relationship with a missionary on the ground in Ukraine that there is severe hunger among a lot of the people in Ukraine and no government programming that's helping them. In fact, Lena, some of you met Lena when she was here. Lena Rotari is the Christian Resource Center director in Ukraine. And she said that they are bringing people in from Eastern Siberia. When they pick them up, they just pick them up out of the field, out of their offices where they're working, whatever, put them on a bus, and just ship them to either Kiev or Zhytomyr. And when they get there, they take them off the bus, and there they are. They arrive with no luggage, no ID, no money, nothing. And she decided to get involved when she walked out the door of her apartment building, and there was a man who was dead leaning against the building. And she said, we've got to do something. People are starving to death because of what's happening. So she moved to Zhytomyr and started working with the refugees there. And after a while, then it started to become known because there were missionaries who were reporting back to people. It became known among organizations, and now Convoy of Hope and Samaritan's Purse are both there working, and the different people who are working with these refugees divide them up to try to help them. So our Tuesday night small group is, I think, at this point sponsoring 17 refugees in Ukraine. So these are people who would otherwise be hungry, and because there is hunger. And it's not because there's not food, it's because of what's happened to them, they can't purchase it. So I think those things might fit this definition of famine as well. Of course, there's other explanations. If we read on in Revelation, we find out more information. Another horse, a red one, this will be the second one, the first one was white, went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him. I looked, and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius. Do not damage the oil and the wine. We could say, if there's war, famine and all kinds of things follow. I mean, that it just does. You know, people's livelihood gets wiped out, the crops get wiped out, and it's problematic. In this case, we also know that this must be some sort of major inflation that's not enabling people to be able to purchase things, because we know a denarius is a day's wage. And a quart of wheat is what you can purchase with a denarius for one person for one day. What if you're a family? What are you going to do? Well, you can buy barley for a denarius. You could buy three, but that would feed three people and not be as healthy as the wheat. And if you use all your money for that, then how are you going to pay for everything else that you need? Clothing, shelter, all of those kinds of things. So it's a very dire situation that's probably brought on by inflation, that's probably brought on by war. Well, Jesus is going to tell us that this is just the beginning of the birth pangs. This sounds really bad already, but this is just the beginning of the birth pangs. He goes on and says, they will deliver you to tribulation and will kill you. I really don't like this part too much. You'll be hated by all nations because of my name. You notice that? You'll be hated by all nations because of my name. At that time, many will fall away and will betray one another and hate one another. Many false prophets will arise and mislead many. Because lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. But the one who endures to the end, he will be saved. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all the nations, and then the end will come. This is really important because it's saying things get so bad that Christians, in order to not be killed, begin to betray each other. You know, it's like it takes a special somebody to be able to stand and say, no, I will not renounce Jesus, and I will not sell out somebody else either. It takes a special sort of grace. We saw it in some of the early apostolic fathers that we looked at, amazing people like Polycarp, who just said, okay, fine, burn me up. I'm not denying Jesus. He's a good guy. He's always been there for me. And so we look at these things and we think, wow, this is going to be really bad. We can't even believe right now the sorts of persecution that are happening to brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world. Christians who could not get out of areas because they were classified as being displaced within their country. They were not classified as refugees. In order for it to get help to get away, you had to be classified as a refugee. So because of the classifications that they were being given, they could not get out of their countries, and so they were stuck in some of these refugee camps that are bad. Now Christians are beginning to work underground and get a lot of them out in parts of the Middle East. They're beginning to get a lot of them out. But it's been a very, very dire situation for them, where they've been living in containers, where they have had torture that's beyond belief, parents being told to deny Jesus and embrace Islam while they're drilling holes in their children's head and saying they'll stop if they will embrace Islam. Horrible things that we cannot even imagine as Christians in the United States. We just can't imagine that these kinds of horrors would happen. And yet, there was a little flyover of one of these camps, and somebody managed to have some Christmas lights, and on the top of their tent, they just wrote Jesus in Christmas lights. And it's like, okay, have a little spunk while you're standing up. You know, it's like a little bit of holding on to what you believe. And so I'm very grateful for the groups that have really risked a lot to go and get them out. There was one guy in particular who got a number of them out before they found him out, and he barely got out with his life. But they have been able to get a lot of people out, but a lot of people aren't out. And so we need to keep praying for them, because there is torture happening to our Christian brothers and sisters that we don't even know about because it's not on the news, because, hey, are these countries going to put it on the news and say, look what's happening here? No. So you have to kind of know somebody who knows somebody to find out what's going on. So it says here that after all of this terrible stuff happens, the gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a witness, and then the end will come. I can't even tell you how many times I have sat in church services, but a whole lot, in multiple church services, in multiple places, and heard missionaries say, well, I know we are not near the end of the age yet, because we have not yet taken the gospel to all the nations. And it's going to be years and years before we do that, because at the rate we're going, it's going to take a really long time. If that's true, at the rate we're going, it's going to take a really long time. We're not exactly being speedy about it. But I'm not at all sure that that's what Jesus had in mind when he was giving this list of things that were going to happen. And here's why. They said, what will be the signs of your coming and the end of the age? And he's starting to list them. Here's what's going to happen. This and this and this and this and this and this. And then he says, and the gospel will be preached to the whole world as a witness, and then the end will come. I believe Jesus here, let me just back up and say, this in no way excuses the church from keeping the Great Commission. We were given the Great Commission. The commission was go into all the world and make disciples of the nations. Baptize them, meaning winning them to Christ, and teaching them to obey, discipling them. That's the church commission. Have we done it? No. We probably, our nation has done better than any nations before it, but that doesn't mean we've done well. So that I'm not in any way excusing our responsibility for the Great Commission. I just don't think that's what Jesus is speaking of here when he's giving his list of events that are going to happen. Because in Revelation we read this, I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an eternal gospel to preach to those who live on the earth, to every nation and tribe and tongue and people. And he said with a loud voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs of water. So I believe when we get to the time of the tribulation that God is going to finish what the church didn't finish. And I think that that's important, because Jesus is giving us a list of events that are concerning the end of the age, not at this point concerning the Great Commission. So now Jesus is going on, and this becomes very interesting, because he's going to talk about sort of a destruction of Jerusalem again. So people get very confused. When are these events happening? Is there one that's happening in 70 and one that's happening at the end of the age? And I think the answer to that is yes. He was talking about two different destructions. The first one is what happened in 70. He comes to the end of his discussion and he says, and now listen up to what's going to happen here, Matthew 24. When you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand Okay. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains. Whoever is on the housetop must not go down to get things that are out, that are in his house. Whoever is in the field must not turn back to get his cloak. It's important that Jesus said this. It's really important because he says, when you see the abomination spoken of by Daniel the prophet, people could have easily said what Daniel spoke of was fulfilled by Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. He certainly fulfilled it. But it wasn't the ultimate fulfillment because Jesus is speaking of it as a still future event. And Jesus is some 160, almost 200 years now after the time of the Maccabees and Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes. Antiochus was the guy who was part of the kings of the north. Remember when we talked about Greece, north, south, east, west, one of the kings of the north, the Seleucid Empire. Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes made a foray into Israel, brought it under his control, took the temple, sacrificed to Zeus in the temple. And at that point, the Maccabees rose up and fought against the Seleucids. Against all odds, really against all odds, they won. And they took the temple back, and Antiochus was killed in 164. They dedicated the temple on the 25th of Kislev, 164. The temple was rededicated to God. We call that event Hanukkah, which happens in November, December. It's usually right near Christmas. The Bible calls it the Feast of Dedication. So we read in the New Testament that Jesus was there for the Feast of Dedication. It's talking about this event. But Jesus is speaking about what Daniel talked about as still future. Well, the temple was taken back by the Maccabees in 164 BC. So if Jesus, speaking in 30, 33, whenever he was speaking, is talking about it being future, it's still future when Jesus was speaking of it. Daniel spoke of it in this way. Forces from him will arise, desecrate the sanctuary fortress, and do away with the regular sacrifice, and they will set up the abomination of desolation. Well, Antiochus did this, but the Antichrist is also going to do this. So sometimes prophecies will have more than one fulfillment. Here's the fulfillment in the future spoken of in Revelation. It was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast. This is the false prophet. It was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. This is an abomination of desolation. That is a future event that has not yet happened but will happen during the tribulation period, the last 7 years of Daniel's 70 weeks of years. Now Jesus is going to be again talking to us about the Great Tribulation, as if what just happened was not bad enough. That was just the tribulation. Now comes the Great Tribulation. Pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation, such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever will. Unless those days had been cut short, no life would have been saved. But for the sake of the elect, those days will be cut short. So he's saying there's going to be such a great tribulation, and this is going to be in the last half of the seven-year period. And guess who gets identified in the last half of the seven-year period? It's when the Antichrist comes to power, is given authority for 3.5 years. Jesus says this tribulation is going to be so great that if it wasn't cut short, there would be none of the elect left. Daniel says, at that time, Michael, the great prince who stands guard over the sons of your people, will arise, and there will be a time of distress such as never occurred since there was a nation until that time. And at that time, your people, everyone who is found written in the book, will be rescued. Here's where the Antichrist is given his authority. There was given to him a mouth speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. So we're now talking about the last 3.5 years of Daniel's 7-year tribulation period. And we know that some things happen during that time. We know that the Antichrist is revealed as being not a good guy and that he breaks the treaty that he had made for 7 years that we saw in Daniel as well. We also know at that time, Revelation tells us, we'll look at this when we get there, that Michael rises up and there is war against Michael, against the devil and his angels, and Michael and his angels are waging war, and the devil is thrown out of heaven. He's like on earth and he can't go anywhere else now, and he is really not happy about it. And so he is causing all kinds of problems for the people who are on earth, and the Antichrist has his authority for 42 months. That's the Great Tribulation, and it's not a time to be alive. So when we talk about when the rapture of the church occurs, and we're going to talk about that next week, the whole class. When we talk about when the rapture of the church occurs, you know, I really hope that the people who think it happens before the tribulation starts are right. I'm in favor of that. Let's do that. Let's go then. I personally don't think that's right, but I'm willing to be really, really wrong on that one. I would really like that to be the case. I more think it happens in the midpoint of the tribulation. And I'll talk about why next week. We'll make all the positions. We'll make the case for all the positions next week. But I really, really hope the people who think it's that the rapture's at the end of the tribulation are really, really wrong, because we definitely do not want to be around for this last 3.5 years. But we'll talk about all those things next week. Now, Jesus is going to tell us a few more things that are important. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, so he's talking about tribulation, not great tribulation, the sun will be darkened, the moon will not give its light, the stars will fall from the sky, the powers of heaven will be shaken. Jesus, this is going to really surprise you, is in total agreement with the prophets who said the same thing, and Revelation, which says the same thing. Ezekiel said the same thing. Joel, in two places, said the same thing. Amos said the same thing. Isaiah said the same thing. Now Jesus is saying it, and John sees it in Revelation. So I really do believe the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall, because there's a pretty good track record here for everybody saying that's true. We see events of this nature in Revelation 6. I looked when he broke the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun became black as sackcloth made of hair. The whole moon became like blood. The stars of the sky fell to earth as a fig tree casts its unripe figs when shaken by a great wind. The sky was split apart like a scroll when it is rolled up, and every mountain and island were moved from their place. This doesn't sound good at all. This sounds like catastrophic events on the earth. And we're only on the sixth seal. We still have, you know, we still have a long way to go in the events of Revelation. But Jesus goes on and says this: then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky, and all the tribes of earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of the sky with power and great authority. He will send forth his angels with a great trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the sky to the other. Okay, we'll talk about this more when we talk about the rapture, but this is kind of important, because I don't think this is talking about the rapture. What, did I just say that? I don't think this is really talking about the rapture. I think this is talking about what Revelation calls the first resurrection, which happens at the end of the tribulation. But let's just think about this for a moment. We know some interesting things about trumpets. I took a class on Jewish feasts and festivals, and they put a great big emphasis on trumpets and the three sounds of the trumpet. Maybe I should bring the trumpet thing next week so we can listen to them. They're quite interesting. But there is a trumpet called the first trumpet, there's a trumpet called the last trumpet, and there's a trumpet called the great trumpet. And they are almost used synonymously in rabbinical literature with certain festivals. The first trumpet, it represents Pentecost. And sometimes they will just say, everybody was in town for the feast of the first trumpet. And they mean Pentecost. The last trumpet is the Feast of Trumpets. And so consequently, there is a last trumpet at the Feast of Trumpets, which is the Tekiah Gedolah. It's a very long blowing. But the last trumpet is always associated with the Feast of Trumpets. The great trumpet is always associated with Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. So those three are used almost interchangeably in the rabbinical literature. So here, Jesus is talking about a great trumpet. Whenever we see these trumpets, we have to remember that the people who are hearing these things were Jewish, and they would have understood the references to these kinds of things, which are just kind of like for us, and it's like, okay, there's a great trumpet. No, this is a great trumpet. That would say something to Jewish people for sure. So I believe that this is speaking of the second coming of Christ and what's called in Revelation the first resurrection. But we'll look at that next week. Interestingly enough, the rabbis believed that when Isaac was going to be sacrificed, but then God provided a ram, and the ram's horns were caught, and so they untangled the ram, and the ram became the sacrifice. Well, the rabbis called the left horn the first trumpet, and the right horn the last trumpet. Don't ask me why. But when they blew the trumpets at Pentecost, they always blew the one that was the left horn, and the one at the Feast of Trumpets was the right horn. I don't know why. I don't even know why they named him that. I just know that's true. It's in the literature. It's just true. But the great trumpet was the what we think of as the huge shofar, which is amazing. So I believe when we look at this, we are now talking about the trumpet that Jesus is speaking of, the trumpet of Yom Kippur, not the trumpet of the Feast of Trumpets, which I believe is going to be the rapture of the church, because it says that occurs at the last trumpet. It's like, okay. So interesting. So let's think about this. Jesus ascended into heaven. In Acts, he talks to his disciples and he tells them, okay, I'm going to give you some more information. He'd already called them together and said, all authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. That's a fairly big deal. Go make disciples of the nations, baptizing them, teaching them to obey. Here you go. Do that. Now he's gathered them together on the Mount of Olives, and he's just about to ascend. He's been with them 40 days after his resurrection. And he's like, okay, now don't leave Jerusalem till the power comes. Because you need the right to act, which is authority, and the ability to act, which is power. Those two work together. Having authority and no power is not so good. Having a lot of power and no authority just makes you a dictator. So you need both of them, and they both need to be coming from God. So he gives them this information, and he tells them, don't leave Jerusalem. And after he said these things, he was lifted up while they were looking on. A cloud received him out of their sight. As they were gazing intently into the sky while he was going, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. They also said, men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? Every time I read that, I just crack up. It's like, he just went up in a cloud and you're asking why they're looking at the sky? This Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven will come in just the same way as you've watched him go into heaven. Okay, so he's from on the Mount of Olives. He goes to heaven in a cloud. So I think he's coming back in a cloud to the Mount of Olives. And that completely goes along with the scripture we read earlier, because it says in that day, his feet are going to stand on the Mount of Olives, and the Mount of Olives is going to split east to west. This is kind of important, because you saw the picture of Jerusalem. You saw the valley alongside the temple on the east side. That's the Kidron Valley. It's a fault. It's a geological fault, and it runs north-south. The Mount of Olives is splitting east-west, and the mountain is moving, part of the mountain's moving north, part of the mountain's moving south. That's a big deal. That's not the way the faults lie. It's like God saying, okay, I made it that way, and now I can make it do this way. It's kind of like God showing, you know, this is me. This is not what you're expecting to have happen. This is me. So I'm expecting Jesus to come back on the Mount of Olives. When his feet touch, I'm expecting it to split. I'm expecting it to be a really big deal, and everybody's going to see him when he comes. It's going to be a big deal. I don't think the rapture is like that. In the first place, Jesus doesn't come down to earth in the rapture. The church is gathered up to meet him in the clouds at the rapture. So this is describing, you know, the second coming of Christ when he comes back. Zechariah says, in that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives, which is in front of Jerusalem on the east. The Mount of Olives will be split in its middle from east to west, by a very large valley, so that half the mountain will move toward the north and the other half toward the south. When will it happen? When will it happen? So here is one of the things that Jesus says. Learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth its leaves, you know that summer is near. So you too, when you see all these things, recognize that he is near, right at the door. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. Of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Wow. I'm really tempted to go too far in what we're going to look at in future classes, but we have a lot to look at, and I want to look at it in great detail. But I just want to say this part about where it says, of that day and hour, no one knows. No one knows the day or the hour, only the Father. We know when the bridegroom came back for his bride to take her back to his home with the friend of the bridegroom and the trumpet, you know, the father of the groom told him when he could come for his bride. The groom didn't know until the father said, you can go. So that was kind of important. But there's something even more important here, I think, that has to do with Jewish holidays and the new moon. And I think this is really super important. I took this class where we talked about, you know, how that various feasts and festivals were determined, and I just took this piece out of a textbook. I'm just going to read it to you, because this is the way they calculated the new moon. There's only one Jewish feast that occurs on a new moon. Everything else is timed from the new moon, but it occurs at a different time in the month. For example, Passover is a full moon because they were trying to leave. They wanted to leave Egypt with a full moon, right? So this is talking about how they calculated the new moon, and it's kind of a big deal. The Jews calculated the month according to the phases of the moon, each month consisting of either 29 or 30 days, and beginning with the appearance of the new moon. But this opened a fresh field of uncertainty. It is quite true that everyone might observe for himself the appearance of a new moon, but this would again partly depend on the state of the weather. Besides, it left an authoritative declaration of the commencement of a month unsupplied. And yet, not only was the first of every month to be observed as New Moon Day, but the feast took place on the 10th, 15th, or other day of the month, which could not accurately be determined without a certain knowledge of its beginning. To supply this want, the Sanhedrin sat in the Hall of Polished Stones to receive the testimony of credible witnesses that they had seen the new moon, to encourage as many as possible to come forward on so important a testimony. These witnesses were handsomely entertained at public expense. If the new moon had appeared at the commencement of the 30th day, which would correspond to our evening of the 29th, as the Jews reckoned the day from evening to evening, the Sanhedrin declared the previous month to have been one of 29 days, or imperfect. Immediately thereon, men were sent to a signal station on the Mount of Olives, where beacon fires were lit and torches waved till a kindling flame on a hill in the distance indicated that the signal had been perceived. Thus, the tidings that this was the new moon would be carried from hill to hill, far beyond the boundaries of Palestine, to those of the dispersion beyond the river. Again, if credible witnesses had not appeared to testify to the appearance of the new moon on the evening of the 29th, the next evening, or that of the 30th, according to our reckoning, was taken as the commencement of the new month, which in the case of the previous month was declared to have been one of 30 days or full. It was ruled that a year should neither have less than 4 nor more than 8 such full months of 30 days. Wow, that's a lot harder than our calendar. So the Jews did not know whether the Feast of Trumpets in Tishri would start on the 29th or the 30th, because they didn't know when the new moon would be seen and there would be witnesses to report it. So the rabbis said, no one knows the day. And they also didn't know the hour it would be declared, because they didn't know when the witnesses were going to come and what time it would be to say that they saw it. So I think we're getting clues when we see these things, which occur over and over in rabbinical writings. And one of the things you notice, if you're forced to read writings, which I was, is that they use this phrase all the time. No one knows the day or the hour. This is not just like Jesus made this up. This is a rabbinical phrase that was used, and it was used primarily of the new moon festivals, but in particular of the Feast of Trumpets. You could not declare the Feast of Trumpets till there had been witnesses to say there's a new moon, and you didn't know whether it was going to be on the 29th or the 30th of the month that you would actually see it, nor did you know the hour when it would actually be declared, because you didn't know when the witnesses were going to show up. And believe it or not, if we read on in that text, which I won't, but if we read on, we find out that the signal fires they had set up went so far that people who were on the other side of the Euphrates River in Babylon were getting signal fires to see that the feast had been declared. So they had this like fire system where they had, I don't know how far was between the hills, I think he said, but I don't remember. But it's quite fascinating to me that these kinds of things would go on. And so when we start getting little clues, like words like great trumpet, and nobody knows the day or the hour, and last trumpet, we have to pay more attention to them than we ordinarily would just being American Christians who have no idea what the Jewish people mean. So I think as we start thinking about all these kinds of things, which we're going to be plugging in next week to the rapture, and which we will plug in some more of it when we get to feasts and festivals, we're starting to see that all of this information is fitting together. It's like a big mesh, and it all exactly fits together. I will tell you that that's really what convinced me. When I was in college, I had a period of time where, you know, I was raised in a Christian home, but I thought, well, I just want to check out other things for myself. I want to know what's out there. I want to know stuff. I want to make sure I'm believing the right stuff. And one of the things that really convinced me about Christianity and the Bible was the fact it all fits together. You keep finding out more information, and guess what? It fits in too. And then you find out more information, and guess what? It fits in too. And you look at all the writers, and you think how many years difference they were and how they spoke different languages, and it all fits together. And I'm thinking, you know, I write a lot of things that go to other countries, and I know that I have trouble when I'm writing with other people who also speak English, and we can email each other back and forth. We still write things that seem contradictory until we edit it. And these people didn't have email, they didn't speak the same language, and they're thousands of years apart, and it all fits together. I mean, that's got to be God. So next week, we're going to look at Jesus coming back for the church, and we'll tie in the rest of the information then in the feasts and festivals. Your turn. Questions or comments? Go back.
Okay, so we know the temple on the mount is a copy and shadow. I'm wondering if Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes may have been kind of a shadow template, that maybe this is the kind of thing we need to be watching
for. Oh, I absolutely think so. Absolutely. He was a type of Antichrist for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And I would be really interested in seeing your list, because I've got a couple people I'd put on that list too.
I've got the list here. I brought the list. I didn't want to read the list. It's pages and it's really little font, but but yeah, you're welcome to look at it. Anybody else? Well, that's because it was such an easy lesson. It's what? Too much to process. Okay. Well, you know it'll be up online, so you can listen a second time. Oh, wait, one more.
Uh-huh. Were there things underneath there?
Yeah, there were definitely, it was a stone walkway, for sure. And under certain parts of it, and there's a disagreement about exactly the excavations, there were definitely mikvahs where people could ceremonially dip before they went up onto the temple, and then a lot of steps apparently going up. I don't think that picture showed as many steps, because there were mikvahs, then there was kind of an ophel, which was like a berm out of soil, to help bring it up a little bit, and then steps that went up after that. So, yeah, it was a long way down.
Inside, underneath, like the floor where the courts, were there rooms down underneath?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And also, since it was open, what about if it, I know it probably didn't rain a lot, but if it did rain, how?
You got wet. Well, there were porticos along the whole outside, was porticos of rooms. That's where the rabbis taught and had classes, etc. So that, just the one part on the south end is believed to have been 9 stories. And it's called Solomon's Portico, but it was huge, huge.
Yeah. Jolene, on the south side of the Temple Mount, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is now, that had Solomon's stables in that area at one time. And there's probably 4 to 7 stories of rooms with arches underneath there, and of course that's all under Muslim control, and they've, as some of us know, there was a big controversy because they'd excavated up against one of the outer walls and it was starting to collapse out, and that's now been repaired since we were there last, as a matter of fact.
And a lot of the underneath part had been filled with rubble,
right?
The area that was Solomon's stable, and now they have, the Muslims have excavated it, and the Jews have really, really been upset about it, because they've just been digging it out with equipment and loading it onto trucks and dumping it in a valley, and they're thinking there could be all kinds of things from the temple that are there that they would want. So right now there's a giant sifting project going on where people can go and you sift through the rubble and look for artifacts. It's sponsored by the Israeli Antiquities. In fact, we're going to be in Israel in May, and one of the things we're going to do is go to the sifting project. And among the things they found a pomegranate from the high priest's robe. They found a number of things that are just very interesting that just got dug out and tossed in a valley. So, and it is true that they almost collapsed the wall of the temple, and those walls stood even during the Roman siege. The buildings got wiped out, but the retaining walls on the mountain were there. The Temple Mount has always been there.
It's sort of a side note, but on the internet, at the Western Wall, there is a live camera 24/7. Mm-hmm. So you can see them gathering. It was really cool. When the president went to the Western Wall, they had white tents set up right there in front of it. But 24/7.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Regarding the large stone that fell on the southwest corner, that in Hebrew it was written for the blowing of the shofar. Remember that in Hebrew? And that's the piece that fell and imploded the paving, Roman paving down at the bottom of the
huge stone
tower. Yeah.
Yeah. It was the place where you blew the shofar out across the city. One more to Mary Joy.
The pictures that you had of the temple that you were showing at the beginning of class, are those going to be online as well?
Yeah, those are definitely online because I put up the PowerPoint as it is right here. So yes, you can get those. Okay, so everybody knows what we're doing next week. Next week, you're going to be working through the section that is concerning the rapture of the church. Next week, same time, same place.